When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at MSNBC.com/app.
Now it's time for The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. Good evening, Lawrence.
Good evening, Rachel, and happy Friday. And this is a show that doesn't in any official way recognize the aging process. So about tomorrow, I'm just going to say happy Saturday. I'm just going to leave it at that.
It's Paul Manafort's birthday tomorrow.
There you go.
Which it's a big deal.
Yeah. So, Rachel, I have a Baltimore Agnew story for you that I've had for years, and I've just been struggling in the last 20 minutes to figure out how to say this publicly. So here's, in my memoirs, this will be much more specific, okay? And and no one involved really except me at this point is still alive. So I went to the World Series in Baltimore years after Agnew, former governor of Maryland, as you've pointed out, and vice president, was forced to resign because of the crimes he committed in Baltimore and in Maryland when he was governor. And so I met at the World Series, as can happen, depending on who you're with, someone I'll call very, very highly placed at the very top level of what they used to call organized crime in Baltimore. And found myself that night at the best Italian restaurant in Baltimore, whereupon that guy, who was incredibly charming and was just kind of rolling along in storytelling, almost in passing when Agnew's name came up, he said a couple of times, "Agnew, great guy, Agnew, great guy, Agnew." Now, as you know, in your training growing up, in dealing with guys highly placed in organized crime, you don't ask questions. And I was in no position to ask questions. I was not in any way a journalist at that point in time. I was not really into my adulthood yet. And so you just listen and you take that. And that was the moment. That was the moment where, for me, all reasonable doubt flew out the window, you know, because there was no Agnew trial, right? And so there was the question of, you know, what did he do? And my sense of it that I picked up in that room that night was that what the prosecutors were onto, what they had, was the tip of an enormous cash iceberg, just a gigantic amount of good guy Agnew stuff that they just never even found out about.
I mean, they put together a 40-count felony indictment against him. So they had a lot. But even when we were doing the research for Bagman, talking to the prosecutors, they were like, oh yeah, there was a lot.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the stuff that didn't necessarily end up in there because it was the time you didn't kind of talk about this stuff. But yeah, the gangster loves him thing both doesn't surprise me and also makes me desperately long for a time machine to go back there and give you ways to keep that part of the conversation going.
I have more details for you on this when no one's listening. You know, what we have been trying to pursue are Secret Service members of Agnew's detail because of this issue of what's going to happen Tuesday in Manhattan. Because Agnew's the only person with a Secret Service detail who ever found himself in the intersection of the criminal justice system this way. And so what we wanted to know was, how about handcuffs and how about, like, did anything like that ever happen? And the Secret Service agents we've been able to talk to, they are, you know, they're up there in age. And they, one of them said, I kind of think maybe it was just the regular process, but I'm not really sure. So the memories just aren't sharp enough to really report on it. But what did you find in your research of all of that for the podcast, whether there was ever a handcuff moment with Agnew?
I mean, it wouldn't have been a handcuff moment because the way it worked. Well, I was just going to say this, the soundbite that we played tonight where Agnew walks out of the courthouse and says to all the reporters, gentlemen, you saw my statement about, you can see guys standing around him who appear to be Secret Service because they're not looking at the cameras. They're looking around and they appear to be looking at rooftops and stuff. They're like, I can't say that they are for sure, but they appear to be Secret Service with him at that point. But the way that it was choreographed at the start of that process is he walked in. They had prepared his resignation. When you resign as vice president, you resign to the Secretary of State for some reason. That's the process. Mm-hmm. So they sent his resignation letter to Henry Kissinger. And then they conveyed it to him. They waited in the office. They confirmed that it was conveyed. Then he was no longer vice president. Then he walked into the courtroom, gave his plea, and then he walked out. And so I don't think there was a fingerprint booking mugshot process, let alone handcuffs, but now I want to go back and reread all my notes.
Right. Well, we'll see how it works on Tuesday.
Wow. Yeah. Thanks, Lawrence. Thanks for the dirt. I love it.
Remember, Rachel, great guy, Agnew. Great guy.
I can't wait to hear the I can't wait to hear the not safe for work part of the story.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you.
Thanks, Lawrence.
Well, Michael Cohen's lawyer, Lanny Davis, is going to be joining us later in this program, and we have a battery of lawyers who will also be joining us. But first, millions of Americans have been waiting for this day for years, and there are others, perhaps hundreds, thousands of New Yorkers who have been waiting for this day for decades. In the case of that smaller group of New Yorkers, they have been waiting for this day for decades because of the way Donald Trump and his father treated them in business deals or as tenants, renting apartments from the Trump family when the Trump family was guilty of racial discrimination, according to the Justice Department in the 1970s in New York City. What those people have been waiting for is the day Donald Trump's name would appear as a criminal defendant. And as of today, that name appears as a criminal defendant in exactly one piece of paper that has been released publicly. It is an order by the judge in the case, Judge Juan Merchan, that allowed District Attorney Alvin Bragg to make the public announcement yesterday that a grand jury had indicted Donald Trump. Alvin Bragg's announcement included no specificity about the charges. That one-page order by the judge carries the title of the case, The People of the State of New York Against Donald J. Trump, Defendant. We're going to leave that image on the screen for a few more seconds for the people who have been waiting for years to see those words in a criminal case. Donald J. Trump, defendant. Donald Trump has, of course, been a defendant in court many times in civil cases, and he is still a defendant in some very important civil cases. But this is the very first time that anyone has ever gotten to see the name as a criminal defendant, Donald J. Trump, defendant. Thanks to the unprofessionalism, reckless disregard for the Constitution, and the rank stupidity of Jim Jordan, we learned something else about the Trump criminal case today. Because Jim Jordan, as the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, continues to have his staff write letters to District Attorney Alvin Bragg, hopelessly pestering the district attorney for information about what is now the prosecution of Donald Trump, information it would be illegal for the district attorney to reveal. We have learned a piece of official information about the charges that Donald Trump faces. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office is so big, with 500 lawyers working there, that the district attorney has a lawyer. That's right, the top lawyer in the district attorney's office has a lawyer. Leslie B. Dubeck is the general counsel of the district attorney's office. That means she is not involved in prosecuting cases and has the time, without taking any energy away from the Trump prosecution, to respond to and, in the process, fully humiliate Jim Jordan and the breathtakingly incompetent Republican staff who write Jim Jordan's letters for him. In the second sentence of her second letter to Jim Jordan, written today, Leslie Dubeck puts something important into writing that we would not otherwise know officially. And that important thing is one letter. She tells Jim Jordan the charges filed yesterday were brought by citizens of New York doing their civic duty as members of a grand jury who found probable cause to accuse Mr. Trump of having committed crimes in New York. When I read that sentence today, I underlined the S in crimes, because that is the first time the district attorney's office has put in writing the word crimes, plural. Crimes. Yes, there have been reports, multiple reports from unnamed sources that the indictment will involve multiple counts, as many as 30. But this is not an unnamed source. This is not a leak of any kind. This is the district attorney's office putting in writing, quote, probable cause to accuse Mr. Trump of having committed crimes with an S in New York. How many crimes? That's the next thing we are waiting to find out. What are those crimes? How many? We might not know the answer to how many crimes until Tuesday afternoon, when Donald Trump is currently scheduled to be arraigned in Manhattan, where the crimes he is accused of by the grand jury will be publicly revealed. Even though the official legal filings in the criminal case against Donald Trump in Manhattan publicly consist of only one page as of right now, we now have several pages written about and around the case because of the profoundly misguided correspondence with the district attorney's office initiated by the three stupidest chairmen in the history of the House of Representatives who have ever been in charge of committees that they now chair. The leader of these three is the mesmerizingly ignorant and cartoonishly fast-talking but slow-thinking chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, James, call me Jim, Jordan. The biggest town in Jim Jordan's Ohio district appears to be Mansfield, population 47,000. Jim Jordan has no idea what he is dealing with in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which has jurisdiction over just 1/5 of New York City, but that's well over 1 million people. It was Leslie Dubeck who wrote the first letter replying to Jim Jordan's request that District Attorney Alvin Bragg testify to the House Judiciary Committee, and she dismissed it as a ludicrous, improper, and unconstitutional request. Jim Jordan's staff then wrote a 7-page reply to Leslie Dubeck's letter, in which they did not dare to renew their request that Alvin Bragg testify to their committee. Wouldn't dare ask that again, which means Big Jim Jordan has already done his cowardly retreat from demanding to hear testimony from Alvin Bragg, which Jim Jordan knows he's never going to hear. And so, as I said, when Jim Jordan wrote that first letter, there was nothing actually threatening about it. Nothing at all. It was like kids playing in a sandbox. It was a group of clowns sending a letter to some very serious people in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. In her second letter to Jim Jordan and his tragically overmatched staff, Leslie Dubeck pointed out that way less than 1% of the district attorney's $126 million budget is derived in any way from federal funding, which Jim Jordan has been pretending he might try to withhold from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. It's New York City, Jim. They won't miss your federal funding, but you will never have the power to take one penny of their federal funding away, and you know it. But the victims of Jim Jordan's propaganda don't know that. The victims who Jim Jordan and Donald Trump fundraise from don't know that everything they fundraise on is a lie. Republicans are already fundraising on how tough they are with Alvin Bragg when Alvin Bragg is ignoring every single word they say.
Leslie Dubek is banging those Republicans around in her letters like bowling pins. Leslie Dubek pointed out that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, quote, has helped the federal government secure more than $1 billion in asset forfeiture funds. Jim Jordan on the Judiciary Committee has secured absolutely zero revenue to the United States Treasury. Manhattan District Attorney's Office, $1 billion contributed to the federal treasury by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office alone. Never mind the taxpayers of Manhattan, who pay more in revenue to the federal treasury than most Republican states do. There are Republican states living off the wealth contributed to the federal treasury by the taxpayers of Manhattan. Leslie Dubek once again renewed her invitation to meet with Jim Jordan and his staff. She said, "We respectfully request that you provide us with a list of questions you wish to ask District Attorney Bragg and to describe the type of documents you think we could produce that would be relevant to your inquiry without violating New York grand jury secrecy rules or interfering with the criminal case now before a court." As with Leslie Dubek's first offer of such a meeting in her first letter, Jim Jordan would be absolutely right if he suspects she is inviting him into a trap. She is. It is a trap of stupid people by smart people. She is inviting Jim Jordan into a room full of Manhattan district attorneys, taking notes about what Jim Jordan wants and exactly how he wants them to break the law for him. Jim Jordan and his staff will never be stupid enough to enter a room with those people. But they may be stupid enough to continue to write their letters to Alvin Bragg and receive replies from Leslie Dubek, who once again told Jim Jordan, "We urge you to refrain from these inflammatory accusations, withdraw your demand for information, and let the criminal justice process proceed without unlawful political interference." Leslie Dubek pointed out that Jim Jordan had nothing to say about Donald Trump's threat of, quote, death and destruction because Donald Trump is now indicted. She wrote, "As committee chairman, you could use the stature of your office to denounce these attacks and urge respect for the fairness of our justice system and for the work of the impartial grand jury." But that is, of course, hopeless, because there is not now a single Republican chairman in the House of Representatives who has demonstrated the slightest comprehension of or fidelity to the congressional oath of office to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. Leading off our discussion tonight are two former Manhattan assistant district attorneys, Dan Horowitz and Catherine Christian. And Andrew Weissman is with us. He's a former FBI general counsel and former chief of the criminal division in the Eastern District of New York. He's a professor of practice at NYU Law School and an MSNBC legal analyst. And Catherine Christian, let me just begin with you and what we're seeing in this correspondence, that unprecedented, of course, correspondence that the district attorney's office is engaging in, very much to my amusement so far, where we have at least today this one little confirmation in writing from them that we are talking about multiple crimes that will be charged when we see this on Tuesday. What are you expecting, given everything we know at this point? Do you have an expectation of what we'll see on Tuesday when these charges are revealed?
You know what? I do not want to speculate. If the indictment is on the seal, I think we can trust that there actually are going to be 30 counts. But, you know, I don't want to speculate. I have no idea. I don't think there are 30 counts of falsifying business records. But it's, you know, I've had some discussion with some lawyer friends of mine, former prosecutors, and we were sort of speculating that maybe, you know, there might be some tax fraud involved. But again, having not seen it, I just don't want to speculate. you know, people thought that the grand jury was not going to come up with their vote until after Passover and Easter. And then, boom, it happened yesterday. So I'm not going to speculate about the 30 counts, if there are, in fact, 30 counts.
Dan Horowitz, time's running out. This is going to be one of your very last invitations to speculate about what's going to be in that indictment on Tuesday. Here's your big chance.
All right. Well, I love Catherine and we worked together a long time. I would bet that these multiple counts are going to be multiple counts of falsifying a business record. And here's why. Because in a falsifying business record case, and I prosecuted many of them and I now defend them, every single time you make a false record in a business record, meaning in this particular case, every check that was written, every invoice that was sent to or from Michael Cohen, every entry in the general ledger of the Trump Organization that relates to the hush money payoffs, each one of those is going to be a single crime. And that's where you get the counts from. Now, what we don't know, and I agree with Catherine, we don't know exactly how many false records were created. But when a prosecutor brings a case of falsifying business records, it's an art and not a science. Now, some people think that you charge every single falsifying business record. So when you have like a large entity and there are many complex business records that have been falsified, you can often have 200, 250 counts. Now, when I was a prosecutor, I didn't like to bring an indictment with 250 counts because when you go to trial, you're going to ask a jury to read through 250 counts when you can pick your 5 or your 10 greatest hits. In this particular case, though, because it's the president, a former president, I think that the prosecutors are going to be precise and they're going to want to link each particular false record to a crime. And so that's where I think you get multiple counts. What I will also speculate, I will speculate about whether there's going to be a conspiracy count that goes beyond Stormy Daniels. Perhaps there's the catch and kill conspiracy that was launched with David Pecker, which Lawrence, you've talked about many times on the program this week. There could be a conspiracy charge and we'll see about that. I mean, it kind of cuts both ways because a conspiracy with falsifying business records is only a misdemeanor. So you say to yourself, why would there be a misdemeanor? Well, it gives the prosecutors the opportunity to tell a story in the indictment. And it also gives the prosecutors an opportunity to strengthen the case to prove Donald Trump's intent, which is obviously critical. So if you simply charged falsifying records related to Stormy Daniels, you've really only got sort of one discrete narrative. But if the narrative goes beyond payments to cover up Stormy Daniels and goes to covering up other people to catch and kill, then the story, the narrative, the allegations are broader and it's a stronger case that way, Lawrence.
Andrew Weissman, when we saw the first letter from Jim Jordan and the Republicans to Alvin Bragg, my wise guy recommendation on this show was to just tear it up over there at the district attorney's office. I'm so glad they didn't follow my advice, which, of course, there was no chance they would. And we now have this really wonderful series that is going on here where the children in the House of Representatives who have absolutely no power to inflict anything uncomfortable on the district attorney's office keep getting these beautifully written instructional manuals about reality on these things in the reply letters from the district attorney's office. It's really become kind of an invaluable set of correspondence for us.
I couldn't agree more. You have probably three legal nerds on your show. And I think just as a matter of practice and in terms of the profession, I read those letters and hats off to the general counsel's office. It just bespoke such, they were so thorough, so well written, so well reasoned, and they were also fearless. They had no problem calling out what this was in polite but strong terms, which I thought was, you know, you're supposed to do your duty without fear or favor. That was struck me. The time that they were able to produce these so quickly made it clear to me that this is an incredibly professional team that is ready for the onslaught that's going to come. And the third is the irony that you have Republicans in the House trying to interfere, not just with a, it would be bad enough if they were doing this with respect to a ongoing federal investigation, but you have House Republicans who I thought were supposed to believe in states' rights saying, oh, we're going to interfere with a completely separate state criminal process as to which we have zero jurisdiction. I mean, so that just tells you it's a bankrupt sort of party in terms of what they are doing. And I just really thought it was great that there was just absolutely no hesitation in calling that out. And I think that's why you're seeing your reaction, my reaction up to just how well done this was. And I think it augurs really well for what we're going to see from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office.
Andrew Weissman, Catherine Christian, Dan Horowitz, thank you very much for starting off our discussion. Please stand by and watch my discussion with Lanny Davis. We will reconvene on the other side of that with more. Lanny Davis, Michael Cohen's lawyer, will join us next.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
Do you feel vindicated?
This isn't a question of vindication. It's not a question, as I stated before, about revenge. This is my position is that at the end of the day, Donald Trump needs to be held accountable for his dirty deeds.
That was Michael Cohen after testifying to the grand jury 2 weeks ago. Joining us now is Lanny Davis, attorney for Michael Cohen. And Lanny, I've been watching your interviews, and I've been watching people waste a lot of time asking you questions that I know you can't answer. I respect the limitations on what you can say. So I want to begin by just giving you this opportunity with the viewer, given what you know to be the public state of knowledge about the case at this point. And without a question from me, because I don't think I'm going to find the secret that unlocks the things you're suddenly going to say.
No, you just might, Lawrence.
But what I'd like you to do is take a minute to just tell the viewer what you think they should know as of Friday night before the Tuesday when they will discover what all the details are of these charges. But given the public state of play at this point, what you think viewers should know and what they should be paying attention to.
All right, three facts. Fact one is the Southern District of New York prosecutors who charged Michael Cohen caused him to plead guilty and sent him to jail. Said this in a public filing in December 2018. I'm quoting, "Individual one, who is immediately identified as President Donald Trump, directed Michael Cohen to pay illegal hush money. Cohen went to jail and did the time. The man who directed him, according to federal prosecutors and Trump's administration, has not done the time." So this case is about whether him directing someone to do the crime makes him guilty. And New York law will apply, I think, in this case, but that's up to the judge. Fact two, Michael Cohen's credibility has been attacked. Let's just assume that Michael Cohen has credibility issues because he pled guilty to various crimes, some of which involved lying. But there's an additional part of the sentence that all the flapping pundits who don't know anything about the facts in this case are all speculating, don't seem to finish the sentence. Yes, he pled guilty, but for crimes that federal prosecutors said were directed by Donald Trump and for the exclusive benefit of Donald Trump. And that's a fact that the federal prosecutors found. And fact three is the reimbursement of that illegal hush money scheme that Donald Trump directed was done in the Oval Office out of a personal checking account of the sitting president of the United States, Donald Trump. Let me repeat that. 12, or rather 11, $35,000 checks were written out from a personal bank account, two from the trust of the company and the rest personally from Donald Trump, to pay back the hush money that was illegally paid by Michael Cohen. So those are the three things that federal prosecutors have found. You don't have to believe me. You don't have to believe Michael Cohen. I guess the final thing I would say to you is that this is not about Michael Cohen's testimony, Lawrence. There are many, many documents, many, many corroborating witnesses, emails, text messages, days, hours, months. We've sat with the prosecutors and gone through documents corroborating, substantiating evidence that Donald Trump is being charged with the crime of paying illegal hush money that, as I said, Michael Cohen did time for. Now we'll let a jury decide whether it was politically motivated or whether it was all about protecting this information from Melania. Because if he doesn't prove that it's all about that and there's any political motivation, a jury can find him guilty. Sorry, I took more than 1 minute.
That's right. In terms of evidence, are you aware of evidence beyond Michael Cohen's testimony that would indicate Donald Trump's intent in the payoff to Stormy Daniels?
Yes. Documentary evidence, meaning
what about,
in writing.
What about other testimonial evidence? Do other witnesses corroborate that?
Yes. Without specifically saying that this is your answer, I will remind you of a Wall Street Journal story about somebody named David Pecker, who with Donald Trump, according to the Wall Street Journal, came to an agreement to kill negative stories to help Donald Trump in the presidential campaign. And on one occasion in August of 2016, that's close to the election, David Pecker and Donald Trump agreed to pay $150,000 to someone named Karen McDougal in order to keep her news or value of the news of an affair with Donald Trump, which he's never denied, by the way, secret. So that story was killed thanks to the money paid by, according to the Wall Street Journal, the National Enquirer. Now, David Pecker is a grand jury witness twice. And the second time had nothing to do with this Costello character who didn't do a thing, add or subtract, just make a lot of noise, but had nothing to do with the case. What I'm saying is there is another witness who had conversations and exchanges with Donald Trump. And according to the Wall Street Journal, I'm not going to reveal anything else other than the Wall Street Journal reporting on this. David Pecker has testimony about his conversations with Donald Trump. And by the way, Michael Cohen pled guilty to that crime. He was charged with the crime of the illegal cover-up by Karen McDougal. People forget this, Lawrence. He pled guilty to that. That was an illegal campaign donation because Karen McDougal was kept quiet in August and September of 2016 for the purpose of not having adverse information in the public domain about Donald Trump having an affair.
Lenny Davis.
Now, he's guilty of that, and he didn't pay the money. He did was write the paper up to do the deal between Donald Trump and David Pecker. That's reporting by the Wall Street Journal.
Yep. And you have refreshed my memory. Can we squeeze in a commercial break here, and could you possibly stay for a little bit more after the
commercial? I would love to, Lawrence.
Okay,
sorry, I went on a little bit longer than I should have.
That's fine. We're going to squeeze in a commercial break. We're going to be right back with Michael Cohen's lawyer, Lenny Davis.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
You have a fundamental problem that even liberal lawyers are pointing out, which is this case does not have an intent to defraud, as that's defined under New York case law. So you're going to see very robust motions, I think, in the near future, a variety of motions, perhaps motions to dismiss. Lenny Davis, Michael Cohen's lawyer, how would you respond to that Trump lawyer saying that intent to defraud is going to be a real challenge for the district attorney to prove?
I'll answer very, very simply. Does he absolutely have any knowledge whatsoever about the facts in this case? This is a lawyer who knows nothing and now is opining about our difficulty in at least Michael Cohen's case, knowing about intent to defraud. But let's start with writing checks. Rudy Giuliani said $35,000 a month checks by a sitting president, Giuliani said, were reimbursements for the crime that Michael Cohen went to jail for. Is there a problem here with intent? And that's a public fact. I know private facts within the room with prosecutors that this lawyer, Mr. Trustee, has no clue. So he's like everybody else that I've been listening to, and not just somebody who's working for Trump, but other talking heads on other news channels, are talking without knowledge. And I don't blame them, but they should not be speculating.
Lenny,
so let's just say, final comment to you, Lawrence. This is a very powerful case about a very serious crime that is not just what Mr. Pence said was a finance crime, a campaign finance crime, as if that's not an important crime. This is called by the Southern District prosecutors who work for Donald Trump a serious crime that can undermine a democracy if somebody can pay money to stop the American people from getting information that they need in order to vote. This is a serious crime. It's not a minor crime. And to disparage it as a campaign finance crime, as Mr. Pence did, is very disappointing. It is a serious crime, according to the federal prosecutors who worked in the Trump Justice Department.
Lenny, in the chronology of the evidence of the case, there are times when Michael Cohen's on the phone with, say, Hope Hicks, and Donald Trump joins the phone call. Or Michael Cohen's on the phone with Kellyanne Conway and other people who we know met with these prosecutors or testified to the grand jury. Are you aware of any of those witnesses to any of that communication that involves Michael Cohen who contradict Michael Cohen in any way?
No, just at the very end. I have to say no, but I was about to say, well done, Lawrence. You're capturing the nature of the evidence that this lawyer, Mr. Trustee, has no clue exists. And boy, is he going to be surprised. Everything. Let's take that one example. What these prosecutors did, and sometimes it was very hard, long days with Michael, going through triangulating. And what's double triangulation? If Michael Cohen says something, then an email, a text message, a telephone call record, a document, another witness, it all surrounds and compounds one piece of evidence, not just Mr. Cohen, but other testimony. Everything is triangulated or two times triangulated. These prosecutors have decided to do the utmost proof of a case, and everybody's saying it's a weak case. You have no clue, and boy, are you going to be surprised.
Lenny Davis, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back with our legal panel. We're back with our Friday night legal team of former Manhattan Assistant District Attorneys Dan Horowitz and Catherine Christian and former federal prosecutor Andrew Weissman. Andrew Weissman, what's your reaction to what we just heard from Lanny Davis?
I think you heard a mini version of what you're going to hear in summation from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which is Michael Cohen. Yes, he's a liar. Yes, he paid money for hush money, but he did that for who? For the defendant, Donald J. Trump. So he's a liar, but he's his liar. And you don't have to just take his word for it. there's other evidence in the case. There are other witnesses, and he's corroborated by documents up one side and down the other. That's the gist. It was a very good, pithy summation of what you're going to hear played out, I think, at trial.
Catherine Christian, I've been studying these chronologies of the phone calls, and there are these moments where, you know, Donald Trump jumps on the phone, and now there's another witness on the phone with Michael Cohen. And so what's that person going to say? And Lenny Davis says no conflict with Michael Cohen's testimony.
Well, I first of all, I agree with Andrew. I wonder if the prosecutors were listening, because I said this is going to be a hunk of their opening statement and their closing argument, particularly when they explain why the jury should believe Michael Cohen because of the corroboration, the documentary evidence, the testimonial evidence. I'm now going to speculate with my friend Dan Horowitz. After listening to Mr. Davis, I said, you know what? I bet you there is going to be a conspiracy count, because that is a way to bring in all that evidence. When he was talking about the National Enquirer, David Pecker, which is the Catch and Kill of the Playboy model, and he did testify, as Mr. Davis confirmed, twice, I said, aha. So you're right, Dan. But it was a very good presentation on behalf of his client, and I think it speaks to what the prosecutor is going to have to say to the jury. This is why you can believe this person.
Dan Horowitz, your reaction to what Lenny Davis just said.
So I completely agree with everything Catherine and Andrew said, but I'm going to give you two thoughts, leave you with two thoughts. One, this is not Alvin Bragg or the DA's team's first rodeo. They know exactly what they're doing, and people should remember that. Forget about everything that Leslie Dubek said, all true. These are highly experienced prosecutors who've brought sophisticated cases and won these cases many times. Thought number one. Thought number two. This is a case which is built on layers of evidence. And that's what Lanny was explaining. This is not just one witness, as Andrew said. This is layers upon layers upon layers brought by a highly experienced team of prosecutors. So I leave you with those two thoughts, Lawrence.
Andrew Weissman, as we go forward, by Tuesday night, we're going to be having a very detailed discussion here about what we know, and we will be out of this stage of speculation. There'll be more to speculate about. But when you listen to Lanny Davis tonight, and one of the questions I didn't get to was, what is his comfort level with Michael Cohen making public comments the way he is? He was on with Joy Reid earlier tonight. It's such an unusual thing. We don't see witnesses doing that. Did the DA ask him not to do that? We don't know. But I haven't heard Michael Cohen say anything in his interviews where I think, the district attorney's not going to like him saying that. He seems to be steering away from the landmines in the interviews.
You can be sure that the prosecutors requested Michael Cohen to not speak. And there's a reason to not speak, because every time he speaks, there is more information and more potential for making a statement that is erroneous that will be used and should be used by the defense in cross-examining him to see if he has been at all inconsistent. That is the defense lawyer's job. And if you're a prosecutor, you really want to keep this as clean as possible. But to Dan's point, this is a team that knows what they have with Michael Cohen. They know his flaws. They know that he is somebody who is incapable of staying away from television and the media, probably very much like his former boss, who also cannot keep away. I mean, these are two peas in a pod, and I suspect you will hear an argument like that when he gets in summation about why they both seem to be moths to the media flame. But it is not a good practice if you are a prosecutor. Every single time they're on, they are probably holding their breath, saying, is he going to say something that I then have to unravel and correct? So he is not helping himself, and he's not at all helping if he's saying what I really care about is the criminal case.
Andrew Weissman, Catherine Christian, and Dan Horowitz, thank you very, very much for joining us on this very important Friday night edition of The Last Word. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you can listen to more of Andrew Weissman's analysis of the Trump indictment on the new episode of MSNBC's new podcast series, Prosecuting Donald Trump.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.